This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.
I'm just one of these silly philosophers who looks at the big picture. Now I want to give you the big picture and just ask you if you find this credible. Way back when, in the primordial soup, there weren't people who made love and had babies. We all know that. Okay. And we do know that after millions and millions of years and billions of years on this hypothesis, there came a time when people started making babies that way. Can you get the big picture? Now, obviously, then, there was a transition from one kind of reproduction to another kind of reproduction. Perhaps the best known method of reproduction apart from copulation is cell division. All right, so let's just grant the hypothesis of the evolution that there was life and that it was developing life and say that life was developing through some kind of cell division, mutation, and so forth. Now, at some point along the line, whatever life forms developed had to have a boy life form and a girl life form. Okay, now again, this is not real sophisticated, I'm just a philosopher, but I understand about boys and girls, right? Yeah. I got that much down. And I know something else about, well anyway, human reproduction by means of copulation. Your girls are aware of this as well. A female life form is not able to bear children, or whatever it is, offspring being born, is not able to bear children through the entire life of that organism. Okay, there's an active period where, for instance, a girl can get pregnant. You all follow me? Now, when is that? You all tell me. What do you say? 12 years old? Can we generalize 14 years old? And you also know that in the female life form, there's a time when she stops being able to have babies. And we call this menopause. And when does that come on? 45, 50, 55. You know, I'm just a philosopher. Rough numbers like this, okay? But I'm going to be generous. I'm going to say that human life, the female organism, has the ability to reproduce for 100 years, which is way past anything that we know in our day, anyway, as the reproductive cycle of a female. 100 years. Now, let's sit back and look at the whole picture. Billions of years ago, For some reason, cells started dividing. And I'm just going to buy this silly story about them dividing and mutations and new life forms coming about. And somehow, a boy organism developed and a girl organism developed. And within that, what happens? You get the girl finally, you know, and you've got 100 years to make a baby. Now, within the one, 100 million year span here. Are you beginning to get the idea that this is not something you'd bet on at Las Vegas? Within this huge period of time, you've got 100 years to make a baby, finally. You better hope that the boy organism happened to come along at just at the same 100-year period, right? And had some idea of what it was going to take to get a baby. I rest my case. If you find that a credible scientific account for how sex came about, then I've got real estate in Florida I want to sell to you because you're really gullible. And after you introduce that, because people enjoy talking about sex and they should understand that argument, then you can go back and get, I think, even more heavy philosophically and talk about such things as, do you really believe life came from non-life? Intelligence came from non-intelligence? Self-awareness came from non-awareness? I mean, these sorts of gaps, I would just tell the person, you know, I don't know a whole lot about science, to be honest with you, but I just, you know, you have to believe in too many miracles for me. We Christians, we're just too down-to-earth, mundane people. All right, so you got to turn the tables on the evolutionists and show they're really the people that are gullible and prone to superstition. And as has already been indicated by Dr. Hodges, they are certainly not objective. They have an axe to grind. They will throw out theories on the simple basis that it is contrary to their religious convictions. They do the very thing that we are accused of doing all the time. Sorry for that, but I couldn't resist. I thought maybe that might spice up your apologetic approach a bit. Now, The question has been raised, what do you do, Dr. Bonson, if you're dealing with a Muslim? Because theoretically, a Muslim could say the same sorts of things that you as a Christian are saying. Because the Muslim has an absolute God, a creator God, and the Muslim has a revelation in a book. And so in many ways, there are formal similarities between Muslim theology and Christian theology. And so now what am I going to do? Well, here's a general rule for dealing with other religions. Remember, I've given you a philosophical approach to apologetics that is based upon comparing worldviews. You don't have to worry about the fact that when you talk to the Muslim or the Buddhist or the Confucian or the Taoist, whatever it may be, that theirs is a religious worldview. For all you care, it's a worldview. All worldviews are religious. The only difference between the Muslim and, let's say, the materialistic evolutionist is that the evolutionist doesn't have rituals and prayers. But there are religious commitments about the nature of ultimate reality and ethics and so forth there nonetheless. Now, having said that, then what you want to do with the Muslim is exactly what you're going to do with the atheist. You're going to say, tell me about your worldview. Tell me about your view of reality. Tell me your theory of knowledge, how we know what we know. Tell me about your ethic, where it comes from. And you're going to look for the very same things in the Muslim's worldview that I've taught you to look for in the atheist or the idealist or the hedonist or whatever it may be. What sorts of things are we going to be looking for? One, we're going to look for arbitrariness. Arbitrariness is contrary to rationality. Two, you're going to look for inconsistency. Inconsistency is contrary to rationality. Three, you're going to look for dialectical tension. That is how the worldview cannot comport with itself or cannot comport with those things that you hold in common. Now, can you do this with Muslim theology? You certainly can. Now, let's let Muslims talk here. See, the point is not to go and tell the Muslim you know all about him and here's what's wrong with him. Let him give you the rope to hang him with. So you say, tell me about your theology. Where do you get your theological opinions? From the Quran. What's the Quran? Well, the Quran means recitation. And the Quran is a series of revelations given to Muhammad and written down and organized. Who gave these revelations to Muhammad? Allah, the only true God. What does the Quran tell us about Allah? Well, you're going to find out at one point or another that Allah is so different from the created order and so different from mankind that nothing in human experience is anything like Allah. There is no comparison or analogy between anything in human thought and experience and Allah. Which is to say that you couldn't say anything in human language based on human experience that would have anything to do with Allah, because Allah is so totally transcendent, the doctrine of mutlaqa in the Islamic faith, so totally transcendent that he has no connection with the created order. Allah has determined the end from the beginning in a fatalistic way, almost in a deistic way, and Allah is so different from the created order that human language is inadequate to say anything about him. Okay, now have I said enough? Are you able now to pick up on this and just point out why this worldview has killed itself? If Allah is what the Quran says Allah is, the Quran could not be what the Quran claims to be, a revelation of Allah. Because the theology of the Quran tells you that nothing in human language could speak adequately of Allah. Therefore, the Quran cannot, in human language, adequately reveal this kind of God. Now, I've done a little more detail on this religion than I might otherwise do in a short question and answer period, just so that you won't be bamboozled by the idea that the fact that there's a claim to revelation means, well, they're equal with us. No, because once the person claims revelation, what you have to do is find out what this revelation says. Let me tell you something else this revelation says. Allah has revealed through Muhammad that there are three people of the book: Jews, Christians, and Muslims. That is to say, there are three people that have verbal revelation from God. It was necessary for Muhammad to say that, especially early in his career, because he, if you know the story of Muhammad's life, he began as a very small contingent, persecuted contingent of Arabs, and he was hoping to gain the support and the sympathy of Jews and Christians distributed through that part of the world. And so he said things which honored the Jews and the Christians. All three are people of the book. And have you ever noticed this? Jews, Christians, and Arabs all trace their lineage, either physically or spiritually, to Abraham, who is the father of us all. So Paul tells us, who are Christians, and those who are of faith are the children of Abraham, the seed of Abraham. So Christians look to Abraham as their spiritual forefather. Jews look to Abraham as their spiritual and their physical forefather. And then, of course, Arabs do as well, because where do the Arabs come from historically? Once again? That's right. Who is a son of Abraham? And because he was the child, according to the flesh, was cast out of the family, Isaac, being the child of promise, becomes the type of Christ, and you know the rest of that story. So anyway, Muhammad says that Jews, Christians, Arabs are all alike. They're people of the book. We trace our lineage to Abraham. And so he granted that God had revealed the Pentateuch, the Torah, and he granted that God had revealed the Gospels. Now, most Christians talking to Muslims do not realize that. But, of course, that's dynamite, isn't it? Because the Quran itself says that one must honor the Torah and the Gospels. Now, it so happens that in the Torah, in the book of Deuteronomy, Moses lays down a test for a false prophet. He says that someone new comes along claiming to speak for God, in the name of God in the Old Testament, Yahweh, Jehovah. If someone comes along claiming to speak for this God and yet calls on you to follow a different theology, to go after a different outlook than has been revealed to you previously, and to follow other gods, then that is a false prophet. In fact, false prophet was to be stoned to death. And so here's the situation. Again, let's just put the whole picture together. Muhammad has a revelation from God, allegedly, and this revelation honors the Torah, which Torah says any new prophet who comes along must not introduce a new God and must give a theology consistent with what you have heard already and been taught already. And now it's a simple step for you to show that the theology of the Old Testament, the theology of the Torah, and the theology of the Quran contradict each other. And so if the Quran is what it says it is, the Quran is condemned of its own. You follow that? The Quran gives you the rope by which you can hang it when it says these sorts of things. There are other things we can get into in Muslim apologetics. There are things in the Quran that are historically, positively embarrassing. Muhammad, you have to remember, was not an educated man. He wasn't a sophisticated man at all. And some have speculated that he received his alleged revelations, for instance, in epileptic seizures and so forth. Now, I wouldn't bring that up to a Muslim who may be offended by that and think that you're getting personal and arguing ad hominem. But you need to know that it's no surprise, because of this man's background and probably his own character, that he would make a mistake as big as I'm going to tell you. The Quran confuses the mother of Mary with the sister of Moses. You remember the sister of Moses? What's her name? Miriam. And the mother of Jesus? Mary. Miriam and Mary sound so much alike that Muhammad confused these. And at one point, he refers to the mother of Jesus as the sister of Aaron and Moses. Okay, so a historical blunder of that sort is helpful to get Muslims to begin thinking about the reliability of their revelation. Are they being arbitrary? Are they being consistent? Do they have a worldview that can account for any knowledge at all? And then any number of other problems might be raised as well. But that gives you a start on how to answer a Muslim, okay? And then you had a question. Boy, we're really going to have to strip mental gears now. You want a question answered having to do with libertarianism as a philosophy of life? Okay, the basics. Why don't I find out, first of all, how many of you, I don't want to waste your time, how many of you know what libertarianism is? Okay, we need to take a minute here. Only maybe a third of you or so. Libertarian philosophy, particularly as it comes to expression in someone like Ayn Rand, is a world and life view that they take as their honorific title. It's really horrible to say this, but they call themselves objectivists. Okay? They believe there's objective truth and there are objective rights and things like that. And these can be discovered through the use of man's reason. The libertarian basically holds, when we get to social philosophy, that liberty, that's where we get the title libertarian, that liberty is the supreme value for society. And that therefore there should be a minimal state. Most consistent libertarians would say there should be no state at all, only voluntary associations that operate on free market principles of exchange. There should be no state, or a minimal state anyway, and that all men should be left free to do what they want and to bear the consequences of their choices. With one exception. Men should be allowed to be free to do whatever they want except interfere with the freedom of others. Because since you want freedom for yourself, then you must equally honor the freedom of other individuals. So the libertarian philosophy basically says that you may do anything you wish except interfere with the freedom of other individuals. Now, what would we say as Christians in response to this philosophy? Are you going to look for any arbitrariness or inconsistency in this worldview? Okay, what is the most evident arbitrary aspect of what I've told you so far? It's that proviso that you cannot violate the freedom of another individual. That sounds so reasonable, and I see a lot of Christians, in a sense, kind of ideologically wilt in front of a libertarian because they agree that we shouldn't do to others what we don't want done to ourselves. But now, where did we learn that? We learned it in the Bible, and Jesus taught us in the Golden Rule. All right, so I agree that I shouldn't interfere with the freedom of other individuals except where God tells me that I should do that. I don't have any problem with the notion that there's, in a general sense, the respecting of other people's rights and freedoms. But you see, I can make meaningful sense out of that, can the libertarian. You see, on libertarian principles, if there is no God, if we're only using man's reason, why should I honor your freedom at all? Let's assume that I'm really, now, pretend Dr. Bunsen's not a Christian and so forth, and I'm not going to give into my Christian worldview here. Just hypothetically, what if I want to exercise my freedom in such a way that I oppress other people, I rape women, I abuse little children, I steal whatever I want, and when people disagree with me, I beat them up? Now, the libertarian comes along and says, now look, you have a right to your opinions, you have a right to do whatever you want with consenting adults, but you have no right to oppress others and to force yourself on others and to detract from the freedom and well-being of others. You may not harm others in the exercise of your freedom. And what am I going to say? Why? Those of you who have seen already Terminator 2, you remember what John Connor does with the good Terminator now that comes back, Arnold Schwarzenegger? Arnold is in a parking lot. He's going to arbitrarily waste a couple of guys, right? And the little boy stops him. And he's instructing now this real advanced robot. He says, you can't kill people. Arnold goes, why? The boy says, you just can't. Why? I mean, that's where the libertarian is. You know, he cannot give an answer. Why shouldn't I use, if my freedom is true freedom, then let's bite the bullet. Let's go all the way. Let's play for keeps. If I'm going to be free, I've got to be free. I can't let you tell me that I have to limit my freedom. Where do you get off butting into my life, Mr. Libertarian? When you stop and think about it, you see, he is violating his own principle because he's interfering with me. But of course, his principle says he can do that to keep me from harming others. But I don't see that he has any reason for saying that. The proviso that I cannot hurt others or I cannot interfere with their freedom is arbitrary. But I'm going to take this a step further. Libertarians, of course, are the leading defenders, the most vocal defenders, let me put it that way, of free market economics in our day. Now, they say that you can do whatever you want. You can exercise your freedom unless you hurt other people. You interfere with their freedom. Now, I want you to stop and think about it. You open a hot fudge sundae shop, and you're doing just fine. And because you're the only hot fudge sundae shop in town, you can charge what you want. What would be outrageous for a hot fudge sundae? $8 for a hot fudge sundae? Would that be outrageous? I don't know. If you like hot fudge enough, maybe even that's reasonable. Let's say $15 for a hot fudge sundae. Even hot fudge sundae lovers are going to scream at that point, okay? But you're getting away with it because everyone's addicted to your hot fudge sundaes and you're the only game in town. Now, I come along and I decide I'm going to compete with you. I'm going to open a hot fudge sundae shop right in the same neighborhood with yours down the street, and I'm going to sell my hot fudge sundaes for $2.50. Now, you don't need a whole lot of sophisticated economic theory to figure out what's going to happen, do you? That's right. I am going to, by opening that shop, hurt the guy who was in business before me, because my competing with him is going to take away his customers. Now, if I gave you a more reasonable illustration, it wouldn't be quite as clear, but you do this just so you see the principle. Maybe he sells hot fudge sundaes for $3, and I underbid him at $2.50. Okay, so it won't be as dramatic, but nevertheless, over time, people, as long as I have, you know, an appropriate competitive quality with him, I'm going to get his trade, and he's going to be hurt. In fact, if I'm really good at predicting what the market will bear and producing a good quality product at a lower price, I'll drive him out of business. Talk about hurting the guy. My use of my economic freedom can be used to actually make him go into another line of work altogether. He's going to have to sell chili dogs pretty soon because he can't sell hot fudge sundaes anymore. Now, let's go back to the libertarian principle that says that you're free to do anything you want except harm other people. Obviously, the exercise of my freedom in the marketplace has hurt this person because he couldn't compete with me. And so on libertarian principles, I should be punished for hurting him or told that I can't do that. Now, if you understood what libertarianism was, I think you would understand how bitter a self-contradiction this is, because the free market is almost a god to these people. And what I've just shown is, on your principle, you can't have a free market. The only way to protect the free market is by having a Christian worldview, where God, who is the owner of all things, tells us the principles of property ownership and where others can interfere and cannot interfere. God tells us what constitutes illegal harm against my neighbor and legitimate harm against my neighbor, be it emotional, economic, or what have you. On the Christian worldview, there is a defense of the free market that doesn't run in then to the self-contradiction of the libertarian philosophy. And so that's my thumbnail sketch and internal reputation of libertarianism. Would you like me to take a couple of questions, or is everyone worn out enough? Well, I'll tell you what, in the place of questions, since they want to get back, could I just make a couple of closing remarks, since this will be the last time I address you, before I go home? I really have a heart for what you all are going to be doing, going off to college, some of you are already in college, and wishing there to think as Christians, and to defend your faith as best you can. So let me say a couple of things about doing that, which have nothing to do with the intellectual side of your methodology. Let me just talk to you about a couple of personal things. Be a little pastoral for a moment here. First of all, remember in 1 Peter 3, verse 15, that Peter tells us that we are to set Christ apart as Lord in our hearts, being ready to give an answer to everyone who asks us a reason for the hope that is in us. And you need to understand that some of the people you're going to talk to don't want to be reasonable. You know, you'll start pressing them for answers to some of these tough philosophical questions or scientific questions, whatever it may be, and you'll find that they'll eventually say, okay, I'm irrational, so what? Or I can believe whatever I want, so what? And again, I watch Christians get in that situation where the person's being arbitrary and doesn't wish to be reasonable or consistent, and then they feel frustrated. It's kind of like, well, how can I get to this person? I have people call me for advice. Dr. Bonson, what do I say now? Sometimes the answer is not to say anything further, but just have the person speak up and to say, that's fine. If you're going to retreat to being totally unreasonable, and irrational and arbitrary and say, I don't have to give an answer for these things. I can believe whatever I want. Or when you're dealing with the Hindu and you show that Hinduism is inconsistent, and then the Hindu says, oh, yeah, well, that's your Western logic and rationality, and I don't buy into that. I'm not going to sweat a great deal to plead with this person to endorse rationality. I'm just going to say, please speak up into the microphone. Please tell the world and everybody else listening to our conversation here that if you want to save rationality, you have to be a Christian. The only way you cannot be a Christian is to go the direction I'm going, and that's the irrationality and arbitrariness. That has shut the mouth of your opponent. Again, he may be talking, maybe going on and on, but ideologically, he's taken himself out of the ballgame. You need to be aware that you have to say that. Apologetics is giving a reason for the hope that is in you. The people who don't want to think reasonably, you see, are really no longer players in the game. And you just need to get them to announce that plenty loud. Because you've done your job if you've shown people that the only way you can be rational is to be a Christian. But in presenting that answer, giving that reason, Peter says, yet with gentleness and respect. And even people who are trained in apologetics and believe this sort of thing, even people like Dr. Bonson don't always live that way. Sometimes we get real heated in our arguments and we give the impression to people, you know, that there's anger involved. And sometimes we don't show the kind of respect toward other people that we should. And we need to be sorry for that. And when that happens, as it does in my life, I'm sorry for it. And I trust that you, being forewarned, will learn that this should not be taken as a personal matter. In the end, you are not defending yourself. You're not defending your own pride and your own dignity. You are defending the honor and the glory and the truth of your Savior, Jesus Christ. And for that reason, you can afford to be offended. You can afford to take a lot of cheap shots. You can afford to not come back with equal vehemence or name-calling or whatever it is that you're having to endure, yet with gentleness and respect. And then the last thing I want to say is that many well-meaning Christians, when they go off especially to non-Christian universities or colleges, feel that they are somehow being unfaithful to Jesus, and they're being cowardly if they don't make a point of constantly having their hand up, as it were, in the professor's face and challenging, and opening things up to some kind of verbal tug-of-war debate with the professor in class. Now, you may have to think about this, and after doing so, you may think that Dr. Bonson is wrong, and that's fine. But after years of doing this sort of thing and being in that kind of setting, I want to suggest to you that you probably, in most cases, hurt your cause rather than help it by doing that. Because when you make a nuisance of yourself in class, other people who might be inclined to think about the gospel get an impression of Christians that they're nothing but troublemakers. And since I don't want to be a troublemaker, I don't want to listen to this anymore. Moreover, you need to be aware of something which will fly in the face of what the professor will pretend and the front that he or she will put out there. Professors do not change their mind in front of their class. Now, I'm not going to say that I can make that an absolute 100%. There may be a few humble souls who didn't have an answer and who admitted that they were wrong. But that is so statistically rare, and there's a reason for that. Human nature is involved, and human nature is not willing to, especially when you're in a position of authority, to admit that you're wrong. A area of study that we call the sociology of knowledge, that is the way in which social relations bear upon the knowing process. And in terms of the sociology of knowledge, a professor who stands before the class is in such a position, socially speaking, that he or she is not likely, even if he or she comes to the conclusion, I've got problems with what I've been saying, is not in a position to say to those who are paying their money to come to you as the expert, well, I must be wrong. Maybe in his or her office afterwards. Even there, the sociology of knowledge will make it tough. And so I'm suggesting to you that the way to witness for your faith and the way to be a consistent and bold testimony to Jesus Christ should not be translated into becoming a nuisance in the classroom. Jesus doesn't call on you to disrupt the class. After all, if you paid your money to go listen to this person teach, you better remember, he's the teacher, you're the student. And if you don't like what the teacher is teaching, well, you still paid the money and you signed up for the course. So let's remember that and let's be polite about it. What should you do by contrast? I would suggest that you write papers that demonstrate that you know the subject so well that the professor says, wow, here's somebody who knows how to study. Not even necessarily papers that refute something the professor has said, although you will earn that privilege. Now, I studied in graduate school, one of the best-known libertarian philosophers in our generation, John Hospers. Perhaps the best-known lecturer in secular ethics around. The man knows the stuff. And he knew that I came from the theological seminary when I was a student. He would say things in seminars purposely to provoke me and ridicule Christian theology. But I knew that that's what he was doing, and so I just let it be water on a duck's back. But then after we wrote our first papers, John Hospers took an interest in me because he found out that I was willing to study and I knew the field and I was worthy to talk to. And then when I wrote my next paper, I did an internal critique of his egoism, not by quoting the Bible and so forth, but simply by showing that on Hospers' own premises, he'd have to be omniscient to run the egoist system. I not only got an A from Dr. Hospers for writing that paper, that he wanted to serve on my dissertation committee. Now, this is the man who was ridiculing me when I first started learning from him. Now, I'm not always a wonderful illustration like that, and I didn't give you the story just so I could, you know, pump myself up. But I want you to know that sometimes a silent demonstration, a polite demonstration that you know what you're talking about is going to be the most effective witness you can give. Becoming a social nuisance is not always honoring to Christ and will often chase away your audience. So enough pastoral exhortation. Keep that in mind.
This recording has been released into the public domain by the Bonson Institute. Duplication, sharing, and distribution is encouraged. For more information about the life and ministry of Dr. Greg L. Bonson, visit our website, BonsonInstitute.com, where we aim to bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ.